Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. In this episode, we speak with director Peter Weber and his fascination with Italian giallo films. I hope you enjoy the show. It's my great pleasure today to welcome Peter Weber, director of Girl with a Pearl Earring.
Hello.
Amongst other films, of course, to Soundtracks FM. And Peter, you brought in a list of some of your favourite film music and films here. And first on the list is The Fifth Chord, Ennio Morricone. And what would you want to tell us about this film that was made by Luigi Bazzoni in 1971?
Well, The Fifth Chord, I think, is a really good example of a Italian genre called giallo, which means yellow. The reason it's called giallo is because in Italy, at the little kind of newspaper stands they have dotted around Italian cities, you see these yellow paperback books. It's the equivalent of série noire in France. So they're thrillers, basically. And so this whole genre has been named according to those paperback books that you get, cheap paperback books. There are things that are always very common amongst giallo films. There's a series of murders, often quite brutal, often using knives. The one thing that unites all giallo films is the fact that at some point you will see a close-up of a bottle of J&B whiskey. So if you're watching an Italian film and you see a J&B whiskey, you know it's a giallo. And in fact, in this film, not only do you see the bottle, but Franco Nero, who gives a fantastic performance as the conflicted cop, is sitting in a car and he's glugging away on a bottle. So you get very, very, very good J&B whiskey action. This period, I think, in Italian filmmaking is very... It's a very interesting one. You know, you had, after the war, you have the neorealist films, and then you go through to stuff like Fellini and Antonioni and those kind of, you know, modernist classics. And then it becomes a bit trashier towards the end of the 60s and the 70s. And this wasn't an era that I was particularly interested in until recently. You know, maybe my tastes are deteriorating with age. But I'd always been a really big fan of Antonioni and a big fan of Fellini, and, you know, walked around with my nose held up in the air. But recently I've got a great fondness for this stuff. Maybe some of the more famous directors, let me think, Dario Argento worked in this genre very famously.
Yeah.
So I've been digging around. Wonderful thing nowadays, of course, about DVDs, you can get your hands on pretty much anything.
Yeah.
And I'm quite active on Twitter, and I ended up falling in with some bad company, some giallo fans who recommend stuff to me, and that's where I discovered this film, which is a late giallo. It's one of only two films made by this director. The other film, Last Footprint on the Moon, is a very weird tale of psychological decay and destruction. I could equally have chosen the soundtrack for that. Ennio Morricone, of course, possibly the most famous.
Well, what can you say about it that hasn't been said?
Exactly. I'm going to try and say something that hasn't been said.
Well, I found out something here. He's worked on 500 films.
Yes, I did, actually. And the thing is that the first thing that you always think of when you talk about Ennio Morricone are the spaghetti westerns.
Of course.
You know, and then other people will know things like his later work, which I'm not as keen, you know, like... Stuff like that. I first discovered his work through the Sergio Leone stuff. But recently, because of this giallo thing, I've discovered this period of music between about 1969 and 1973, which is really fascinating because he's influenced by rock music, he's influenced by psychedelic music, he's influenced by the kind of avant-garde and kind of jazz rock stuff
that was going on. Modern classical music.
Exactly, yeah. And modern classical music. And you can hear a little
and
bit
mixing of, it all together.
Precisely, you can hear a bit of Miles Davis in here.
Yeah.
You can hear some, and it's quite edgy, and some of it's quite atonal and really, really brave. And you hear very little film music like this these days. You know, so
good.
I just, and the film itself is absolutely fantastic. It's a cop. You know, I mean, it's not like it's breaking any bounds because it's a genre film, but the way it works within the genre is great. A cop who's down on his luck and is trying to solve this series of murder cases. The resolution doesn't quite make sense, but the journey as you're getting there is quite amazing. And you can pick it up as a cheap DVD for about fiver. The Fifth Chord.
Great.
It's got a completely different title in Italian whose name I forget.
That was some music from The Fifth Chord by Luigi Bazzoni, and the music was by, of course, Ennio Morricone. Passing on to your next choice, Peter, it's one of my favourite films, Pierrot Le Fou by Jean-Luc Godard from 1965, and Jean-Paul Belmondo and Anna Karina are on the run from Algerian hitmen in France. What has led you to pick this one?
This is the reason I do the job I do. You know, when I was 15 years old, I think, Portobello Road, I lived in West London, lived in Hammersmith, used to hang out in Portobello Road. I remember a friend of mine, who was kind of a couple of years older, taking me to the Electric Cinema. It's now changed. It's now a very fancy cinema. It's part of the Soho House chain and everything. Very plush. Back then, it was a right old flea pit.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, there were like old hippies asleep in the back seats and fleas literally in the seats. But it was a repertory cinema because this was an era before DVD, I'm that old, before VHS, if anyone can remember that far back. So to see old films, you actually had to go to the cinema or you'd have to sit up late and watch stuff on TV, and there were only three channels on TV back in those days.
Yeah.
Not that you're not old enough to remember this, are you?
Yes, of course I am.
So I went in. I knew nothing about Jean-Luc Godard. I knew nothing about the French New Wave. I just knew I was going to see some, you know, funny foreign subtitled film. And it blew my tiny teenage mind, basically. I fell completely in love with Anna Karina, the star.
So did I.
I mean, had such a crush for years and still have, frankly. But as a film, it's sort of, on the one hand, it's kind of a thriller. But on the other hand, it completely dismantles a thriller. You have characters who talk to the camera. You have these strange comic skits in the middle of it. Suddenly it breaks into a kind of a lecture about the Vietnam War and a bit of agitprop theatre. So it continually surprises you and confounds you and comes at you from a different angle. But it's also a really, really romantic, and it's a kind of tragic love story. And as a very pretentious teenager, I just fucking loved it.
Yeah. Now, there's as far as the score goes, it was written by Antoine Duhamel, but I remember it for the Albinoni piece that is used as he's strapping on the dynamite round himself to blow himself up.
Yeah.
And they play the Albinoni piece. But was there something that you like about the Antoine Duhamel?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's also, just before we get on to the Duhamel, there's two or three songs that she sings as well. Maline de Chance, so there's that, and there's, yeah, so you've got these kind of almost French cabaret music hall turns. It's an incredibly haunting and evocative score. It's often mixed in with voiceover, which are actually quotes from poems by Rambo or by Lorca, and it has a magical, haunting quality that takes the film to quite some other place. It's what gives the film the depth of its emotion and the touch of tragedy, because the film itself, in a way, what happens on screen, you know, it can be quite distancing at points because you're in the genre and then you're popped out of the genre. But the film really, I mean, the music really manages to get you inside the head of this haunted guy who's running away from his bourgeois lifestyle, has fallen in love with his babysitter. Based on a novel by Lionel White called Obsession, which is a pretty tacky série noir, a bit like we talked about Giallo beforehand, really tacky American thriller. I bought it, I managed to find a copy and read it, and it bears very, very little relationship to the film. The only thing that is the same is the setup, basically. And what Godard has done is he's taken it off to somewhere else. But I think this has got a haunting poetry and beauty to it, this soundtrack.
And that was some music from Pierrot Le Fou, written by Antoine Duhamel. And on to your next film choice here, which is Apocalypse Now 1979, written by Francis Ford Coppola and Carmine Coppola. And we're going to actually play the only piece of music in it that's not that's an actual song, and it's The Doors. And would you like to comment on that, Peter?
Yeah, it's most of the things that I've the soundtracks I've chosen are actually traditional film soundtracks. You know, there's some are played by orchestra, some are played by synthesizer, but nonetheless, they're traditional sort of, you know, pieces of music scoring bits of film. But you know, some of the most memorable moments in film are actually accompanied by pop songs or rock songs. You know, and I mean, this is something that probably went back to, I don't know, like Elvis movies and stuff like that beforehand. But you know, where people were obviously, or musicals, people were singing on screen. But the idea of actually having a piece of contemporary music that, I mean, I think it probably really came into vogue with the Simon and Garfunkel track, Mrs. Robinson, for The Graduate. You know, which obviously as a film was a big success and the tune was a big success. And I think that's when it started that vogue of incorporating pop songs, which can work brilliantly.
You've also got the added thing that this actual song was written while they were in Vietnam.
Exactly. So it's redolent of that whole era. You know, it has that. It's that whole, I mean,
They would have been listening to this.
That's it. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. But there's something about the kind of, because it's a very tortured, it's a very dramatic song, quite over the top in a way.
Totally.
You know, and it just so perfectly. You can't imagine this film starting any other way. It's one of my favourite films ever. I think partly because I saw it when it came out at the cinema when I was like 15 or 16 years old, whatever. And it really, it was very, very impactful. And just that opening with the sound of the fan in the room and the helicopter blades that are going on, and the, you know, the vision of the jungle blowing up, helicopters, and then Martin Sheen laying back in the bed looking up, and then, you know, that kind of wonderful, mysterious opening notes of Ray Manzarek's organ and Jim Morrison's kind of smooth as Guinness as
the end at the beginning
voice. Yeah, exactly.
Beautiful.
And it has it's just such a great use of pop music, exemplary, and a great beginning to a great film.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end, no safety. Surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be? So live madness and free, desperately in need of some stranger's hand in a lost in a roaming wilderness of pain, and all the children are insane. All the children are insane.
So here we have your next choice here, a film that I haven't seen, I wasn't aware of, because it's quite recent, came out in 2014, The Duke of Burgundy from Peter Strickland. Can you tell us something about this?
Yeah, I think he's a very interesting filmmaker, and Duke of Burgundy is a low-budget, very intense, I don't know what you would call it, an erotic thriller, maybe? Mm-hmm. It's really a chamber piece about the relationship between these two women and the power balance that goes on in a relationship between someone who's dominant and someone who's submissive, and the way in which, actually, the submissive person can in some ways be more controlling than the dominant person. It's playful, teasing, quite erotic, but in a very laid-back, tasteful way. And it owes a lot, actually, to films around the time of this era, the Giallo era that I was talking about earlier on. It's like the more light, playful variant of one of those. And the soundtrack itself...
By Cat's Eyes, which is a duo, Faris Badwan and Rachel Zafira.
Yeah. So it's got a lightness of touch. I think it's much lighter than the other music that I've chosen. It is pastiche. It does hark back very strongly to another era, but it's immaculately done, and it's so important to the impact of the film. It draws you into this kind of quite precious and singular world that Peter Strickland has managed to create. I think he's a very interesting voice.
It's about butterflies and moths, isn't it?
It's got lots of butterflies and moths in it. Yeah. And of course, any time you have butterflies or moths in a film, it's I always think that it's a reference to Brakhage, the experimental filmmaker, Mothlight, which is his famous film. Definitely worth seeking out. And it's just one of these, now and again, there's a soundtrack to a movie that you actually, you know, you get hold of and you play in your daily life.
Right.
And this is one of those. So this is one of those. I dug it up on Spotify and I just put it on, and it kind of, you know, it's got a... It transports you back to sort of like mid-1960s Italy or something. So, right. You know, it's very pleasing in that way.
Was some of the music from The Duke of Burgundy, and the music was provided by Cat's Eyes. That's Faris Badouane and Rachel Zephira. Next on the list is another film I haven't seen, Beyond the Black Rainbow from 2010 from Panos Cosmatos, the director, a young woman escaping from a futuristic commune. And the music by Sinoia Caves. I think I pronounced that right. What can you tell us about this, Peter?
This was a very good friend of mine introduced me to this film. Actually, first time I saw it was on a screener. It'd been submitted for a film festival, and his friend was working at a film festival and slipped it to me. It's an amazing piece of work. Panos Cosmatos is the son of George Cosmatos, who directed, amongst others, one of the Rambo movies with Sylvester Stallone. So his dad was a Hollywood director, but who tragically died very young. Panos lived, you know, has kind of lived in seclusion on this little island near Vancouver. He's now moved into Vancouver. He was obsessed with films, but when he was younger, before his dad died, his dad wouldn't let him watch movies unless he approved of them. And so Panos became obsessed with these, like, VHS video nasties, the covers that he would see, but he was never allowed to actually play the films themselves. What he would do is he would imagine what the films were like. And so this film is really, it's inspired by that. It's his imagining of a kind of trashy early 80s horror science fiction film. But it's kind of a work of genius. It's very immersive. It's got amazing. It's a very low budget science fiction film. That's the thing. That's the first thing to say. It's quite edgy. It's not for everyone. It's more about the experience of being immersed in it than it is the narrative. Mm. But the use of lighting, the use of camera movement, the kind of particular bizarre world that he conjures up. It's a film about a girl who's kind of trapped in this. Place where she suffers sensory deprivation. They're experimenting on her. There's an obsessive doctor whose brain has been fried, as we see in a fantastic sequence. He's put into an isolation tank, and he's given an enormous dose of a very, very, very powerful hallucinogenic drug, which basically screws his mind up and, you know, turns him on the path to darkness. It's a deeply bizarre movie, and yeah. It's deeply wonderful.
Yeah.
And the best way to see it, really, is as I saw it the second time in Los Angeles. They did there's a thing called Cine Family. It's midnight screenings in downtown LA, and they crank the speakers up, you know, and the film is overwhelmingly red because you have these kind of weird glowing lights that are in there. And when you come out, I mean, you really feel like you've been injected with, you know, some kind of weird hallucinogenic drug yourself. And I mean, you'll hear the music itself is kind of slightly a pastiche. Once again, like the last one, slightly a pastiche of 80s music. It's very synth led. So it's a different thing to orchestral. And you know, it's deep. Okay. There.
I should point out that Senoia Caves, the soundtrack contributor, is essentially Jeremy Schmidt from a Vancouver band called Black Mountain. Here's some music from Beyond the Black Rainbow. Thank you. And that was some music from Beyond the Black Rainbow from Sonoya Caves. And now we'll move on to a great choice, Henry Mancini, and music from Touch of Evil, Orson Welles' classic from 1958 with Charlton Heston running around on the Mexican border in black and white.
Yeah, this is, I mean, funnily enough, I saw this film in the same era. It was, you know, I spent a couple of years going to the Electric Cinema, and it's where I got all my early film education. And, you know, my first love was French New Wave, having been awakened to that by Pierrot Le Fou. And then through reading about these French filmmakers, I then discovered people that they were impassioned by. So that led me to Orson Welles. So this is a film by Orson from the late 50s. He's basically, during this period of his life, he's pretty much in exile in Europe. But he's invited back by the star of this film, Charlton Heston, to make essentially a film noir. And it is a classic film noir from the period. Although it's set in Mexico, most of it's shot down on Venice Beach. And around there. It's a wonderful, you know, I mean, Henry Mancini obviously responsible for many classic film scores, and this has got that wonderful kind of almost swing feel to it.
Yeah.
It's a great tune. I mean, he also did Peter Gunn, for example, and some other
and the like Pink that. Panther
and
thing.
Pink Panther. You can hear a little bit of Pink Panther in here. The thing about this is that as the opening theme, it runs over the entirety of an opening shot, which is many, many minutes long. It's one of the classic early single takes. So the camera follows the car, that is being driven by a man and a woman, and we see it going through the border, and eventually the car blows up. And it's a wonderful bravura piece of cinema making that, you know, many, many filmmakers put up there as one of the greatest one-shot moments ever. There's a great story that Orson Welles tells, because he did that shot 5 or 6 times in the middle of the night. Every time he gets to the security, you know, the border guard at the very end, the camera would come and rest down on him, and the guy would fluff his lines. And so they'd have to set the whole thing up again. You know, if you're doing a single take, it all needs to work. Yeah. So Orson Welles in his interview, and it's true, if you look at the film, you can just see that the dawn light is beginning to break in the background.
Because it's the very last
take. The very last take. So, and in the end, I think he just said to the guy, look, if you can't think of what your line is, just don't say anything. But they did get it right the last time. The whole score for this is fantastic. Classic, moody American film noir. It's brilliantly photographed. Great performance by Orson Welles. If you haven't seen it, you really should.
Yeah. And, of course, Henry Mancini, drafted into World War II, played in an infantry band and liberated a concentration camp. Did you know that?
I knew none of this.
And he, of course, did Breakfast at Tiffany's, the score to that, including Moon River, of course.
Yeah.
And he recorded 90 albums with RCA, and really is associated mainly with the emergence of easy listening music.
Right.
You wouldn't believe it, listening to some of
them. No. Although I guess you can hear a bit of that. I mean, easy listening, of course, when I was growing up, everyone hated easy listening, but then it suddenly became, you know, in a retro way, became really trendy at some point, didn't it?
Here we go.
Thank you.
And moving on from Touch of Evil, we've got a film called The Night of Counting the Years, also known as The Mummy, from 1969, from Chadi Abdel Salam, music by Mario Nasimbeni. Peter, tell us something about this.
This film, it's an Egyptian film from the late 60s. I first saw it, I was in Doha at the first Doha Film Festival, and Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation had paid to do a restoration of this film. It's been out of circulation for years. You can see it on YouTube, but it's an awful, crappy, scratched-up old print. And so this is the first time I'd seen it in wonderful, lustrous kind of colour and sound. And it's really super powerful. I mean, there's a bit of backstory to this in that the reason that it's on my mind at the moment is I found a copy of this film from the Cinema Foundation, got them to send it to me, and I'm using it because I'm making a film about Tutankhamun and about the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb.
Okay.
And so I've been using this as a kind of touchstone, as a piece of inspiration to play to people in terms of the mood and the atmosphere. It's a deeply sinister kind of film. And I was never, until I got hold of a copy of it, I knew the film was very strong and impactful, but I hadn't really tried to analyse what it was that had made it so powerful, because it's very slow. I mean, it's one of the slowest films I've ever seen.
And very long?
And no, it's not too long. It's not too bad.
Just slow.
From that point of view. Slow, but I really like slow films.
Yeah.
As you may, if you've ever watched any of my films, you'll realise that. You know, I love Tarkovsky, for example. But to the last couple of times I've been watching it, I've been trying to work out what's what. And there's two things in there that I think really give it the atmosphere. One is the use of sound, and he uses this the whistling of desert winds, which I think is actually a synthesized track. And the other thing is a very, very bizarre electronic score. Super avant-garde. It's like a weird rumbling, subterranean rumblings or something. Quite unlike anything else that I've ever heard beforehand.
Yeah.
So it was... I guess I'm very much, you know, I'm spending a lot of my time at the moment looking at hieroglyphs, looking at the
archaeological
stuff at pharaonic tombs and the rest of it. So this is uppermost on my mind.
And this is something from that you've had a fascination with for years, right?
Yeah, because I mean, when I was, I can't even remember how old I was, like 9 or 10, I think, there was a big exhibition at the British Museum, which was when they first brought the Tutankhamun treasures over to the UK. And at that point, I fell completely in love with that. I started reading a lot about Egyptology, and I decided I wanted to become an archaeologist. That lasted until I was about 14 or 15 when I discovered pop music and girls.
Yeah.
And, you know, then it all went wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sam, what's the name of this film that you're working on?
It's called Tutankhamun. It's a four-part drama for ITV.
Okay, great.
So it should be out middle of next year.
Well, I look forward to seeing that on the screen. And I just want to say something about Mario Nasimbeni. He scored 150 films.
I'd never heard of him beforehand, and I had to, when I was looking to give you the list, I had to look him up because I didn't have a clue who he was, and I'm not aware of any of his other work.
No, and he apparently worked over six decades.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, it's interesting. I mean,
active,
it's a bit
man.
Like the earlier Morricone stuff. It's a similar period. There was a period of time there when, you know, experimental music was not that it had entered the mainstream, but people were much more aware of it, I think, than they are now. I think audiences were maybe braver. And there's a friend of mine whose father was a composer, Serena. Her father was Luigi Nono, and you listen to his stuff, it's really out there. So there was a movement in the late 1960s, I think, of weirdness, you know.
Yeah, long may it live on. Let's listen to a piece of this music from The Night of Counting the Years. So now moving on to the next one on your list is a great choice. Where Eagles Dare from 1968, Clint Eastwood's crazy raid on a Nazi castle, directed by Brian Hutton and music by Ron Goodwin.
I mean, I realised, I was looking at my list and I thought... You are a pretentious twat, Peter. But I'm not, you know, this is the stuff that, as with making any list, it's the mood you're in on that day. On another day, I'd probably have done a different list.
There's nothing wrong with your list, Peter, don't worry.
But hey, and I thought, I need to mix it up a little bit. One of the first records I ever got, there was a label, I don't know if you remember it, called Music for Pleasure, MFP.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so one of the first records I ever got was Great War Movie Themes. I got it for my 8th birthday, and this was on it. And in fact, a friend of mine, who goes to boots, Kevin Mills, used to be a bass player in a band called Flesh Falulu years ago. He goes to boot sales all the time, and he found a copy of this.
So
I've been listening to some of these tunes again. I'm not making any claims that this is a great movie by any means. It's very dated. All
great piece of music, some great music.
I loved this film when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I seem to remember this. Okay, never mind. I really loved this film. You know, there were a lot when I was growing up. There are still a lot of World War II action adventure films. It's supremely silly, but the music itself is rather stirring and rather dramatic and rather wonderful.
Absolutely.
And for my sins, I used to put on Great War movie themes, and I mean, I was about 6 or 7 at the time, and I had my little Airfix soldiers, and I would perform military maneuvers around the dance set.
Thankfully,
we've moved on a bit since.
Well, I'll tell you quickly a few things about Ron Goodwin.
Yeah.
He scored over 70 films, which isn't a bad achievement, and he was from Devon, and his father was a policeman.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, there you go. Well, I never.
Here we go. Where Eagles Dare. And that was some music by Ron Goodwin from Where Eagles Dare. And next on the list, we've got a sort of feature on Stanley Kubrick, who's obviously one of your favourite directors.
Yeah.
With looking at The Shining, Clockwork Orange, and maybe 2001.
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk generally about Kubrick. You see, there's the other record that I used to have, as well as Great War movie themes, was 2001. My dad took me to see 2001. I did ask him when we left the cinema to explain the end. He was never able to explain the end of it properly. And I bought that film, and I think I bought the film soundtrack, and that really affected my later music taste, because although it has got things on it like the Strauss waltzes and all this very light stuff, it's also got some deeply weird stuff in there, like Ligeti, you know, like strange, atonal, experimental, late 60s Italian music, you know, and it's interesting thinking about that list. There's a fair bit of that kind of stuff that's in there. Kubrick, as people may know, Kubrick did actually commission a score for this film, but he had so fallen in love with the guide music, you know, the temporary music that he'd put in when he was cutting, when he replaced it, he didn't think it was as good. So he went back to, you know, the famous one is also Sprach Zarathustra, and some of these others. So that was a fair, I mean, you know, the film is an amazing film. I mean, it kind of is it invented modern science fiction, but it's not the only one of Kubrick's soundtracks that are great. I mean, if you look at most of his films from that era, Clockwork Orange is a soundtrack that I've played to death. I had an old cassette. I remember I used to play that all the time. I mean, it's got wacky songs on it, like I Want to Marry a Lighthouse Keeper. It's, you know, it's got some classical music on it. And then it's got this weird and wonderful synth stuff from Walter or Wendy Carlos. And there's a story.
Yeah.
I don't think you're allowed to call Wendy Walter anymore, otherwise you get sued. So we should be careful what we say.
Okay.
Because Momus, the musician, wrote a song about Walter or Wendy Carlos and actually ended up getting sued and had to withdraw the record.
So we'll call her Wendy Carlos then?
We'll call her Ms. Carlos.
Ms. Carlos.
Yeah.
Ms. Carlos.
And that's an early example of a synth score, and is very, very powerful. And even if you look at something like Barry Lyndon, The Choices, The Schubert, and so on, it's very, very, you know, really, really strong.
Yeah.
And then you have, I mean, you know, his Vietnam movie, great use of pop music in there, Surfing Bird, and so on and so forth. You know, all in all, a master filmmaker.
And Carlos also did score The Shining, too.
Yes, that's right. The Shining, as you may notice, the back of my iPhone cover is, in fact, the pattern of the carpet on The Shining.
That's great. I hadn't noticed that.
So there we go. So I do. And one little known fact, I own Stanley Kubrick's car.
Wow.
So I found on this, once again through Twitter,
kind of car is it?
It's an old bashed up Merc. I mean, it was the last car that he had in 1985. It's in a bit of a state.
And you haven't done anything to it?
No, of course not.
Of course
not. And so now and again, I like tooling around with Stanley's music playing. I mean, it cost me like a grand, basically.
Yeah,
I picked it up really cheap. And anyone wants to know any more about that, there's a fantastic website called Cinephilia and Beyond, and they did a big feature on it with photos of the car and everything.
So there's in there. And Ms. Carlos started off music with an album of J.S. Bach on electrical music.
Switched on Bach. Yes,
that's right. Started off, yeah. Anyway, here we have some music from Stanley Kubrick's films. And that was some music from Stanley Kubrick's films. I'd like to go on to your next lovely choice, John Carpenter. I mean, he's a true American auteur, I think. Totally underappreciated, very interesting filmmaker. And, of course, he scored a lot of the music on most of his films himself. And you've picked Assault on Precinct 13 from 1967.
Yeah. Is it 67? I thought it was later than that.
Oh.
I think it's 73, but I'm not gonna promise.
Might be a spelling mistake on this list.
I think it is, because I think 67 he made, he made that Dark Star, which was a fantastic very low budget science fiction movie. I could be wrong. This is a low budget exploitation film. It's an example of how you can write something that's very haunting but very, very simple. It's a very early example of the use of the synthesizer as opposed to, orchestral soundtrack. And it's got a wonderful doomy feel to it. And it's like an earworm. Once you've heard it, It's very, very difficult to get it out of your head. And listen, you're a musician, so you know sometimes less is more.
Absolutely, most of the time, actually.
Right, and so this is very, very minimal. You know, he just uses a few notes and a slight shift in, it's just one of those that stuck with me over the years. And in fact, as you say, he wrote music for this, for Halloween, for many of his films.
And most of the music he's done, it was very effective.
It's
amazing.
It's very true. I mean, I think part of the reason that he's underappreciated is that there comes a point, I don't know what happened, but this can happen to people. His early work is amazing. I think there's a certain point where the work, I don't know whether it goes off the boil or maybe it's just not as much to my taste, but his later films haven't been as interesting or indeed as successful as the earlier ones.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the moment he pops his clogs, just like Wes Craven, the dear departed Wes Craven,
everyone will reappreciate
it. People will reappreciate it.
Of course they will.
Yeah.
Here's to John Carpenter and some music from Assault on Precinct 13. that was some music from Assault on Precinct 13 from John Carpenter. Finally, on your list, one of my favourite movies of all time, Hitchcock's Vertigo from 1958. Hope I got the year right there. With James Stewart and Kim Novak, written, of course, by Bernard Herrmann. Let's have some words from you about this.
You can't really, you know, you can't, you have to choose a Bernard Herrmann soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's simple as that. You know, he is one of the masters, and as was Hitchcock, and, you know, he had a long collaboration with Hitchcock. Mm. You know, part of me was wondering about, you know, because there's a number of scores that I love. I mean, you know, Psycho, for example, is a very, very famous one. But there's something very compelling about the soundtrack to Vertigo, and also just the story of the movie, because it's a movie that when it came out, was really disliked. Mm. You know, it was a disaster for him. Mm. I mean, it did very, very badly, got terrible reviews. People didn't get it at all. They thought it was weird, as indeed it is. But it's now been reassessed, and it's seen by many as one of the greatest Hitchcock films ever. And in fact, currently, you know, whenever there's lists of top 10 films, it often ends up in there. So,
yes.
So its reputation has shifted considerably since the late 50s when it came out. And it's a, you know, the titles as well, which are Saul Bass titles, and the combination of this music, they put you into a certain state of mind before you even see the first image of the film, you know, and you've got that kind of gyroscopic feel of the camera disappearing into the graphics, and this swirling orchestral tune. It's very obsessive, very dark, as is the film itself, you know, slightly, you know, it's a kind of bit of, it's very psychological, very queasy.
Perverted almost.
Yes, definitely, definitely. It's very, very bizarre. Mm. And so it's a, you know, fitting way for us to end, I think.
Beautifully shot. Here we go, Bernard Herrmann's Vertigo. And that was some music from Bernard Herrmann from Hitchcock's Vertigo. And Peter, thank you so much for sparing the time. I know you're a very busy man at the moment, one thing or another, and really pleased that you could share your some music, favourite film choices with us. And thank you very much, and all the best for your next projects?
My great pleasure. I actually really, once I sat down, once you'd finally bullied me into sitting down and making a list, I really enjoyed it. The first couple of minutes, I was sitting there going, God, what am I going to choose? And then they just, you know,
it came out.
And then I had to actually stop myself because I could have given you another dozen, but...